versus Haynes and Boone and the directors.
May it please the court, Scott Kidd, I represent John and Jeff Woolley. This appeal grows out of a rather complex bankruptcy proceeding involving the Schlotzky's restaurant chain. The principal issues today in this appeal are whether the claims that the Woolleys wish to pursue against the Appellees have been properly preserved in the plan of reorganization and liquidation, and two, whether and therefore the administrator has standing to assert them, and whether the Woolleys can obtain derivative standing to assert those claims on behalf of the administrator. The Woolleys were officers, directors, shareholders, and creditors of Schlotzky's. The outside directors, as I will refer to them, were outside directors at Schlotzky's. The Woolleys were ultimately, in 2004, terminated as officers. They then subsequently resigned as directors. And Schlotzky's filed bankruptcy in August of 2004. Upon the bankruptcy filing, Haynes and Boone, who had been counsel to Schlotzky's before that, sought to become counsel to the debtor in possession, made the disclosure that's required, however, listed no claims or conflicts with Schlotzky's, no claims against Haynes and Boone, potential claims on behalf of the corporation. The Woolleys sought to have the debtor pursue claims against Haynes and Boone and the outside directors, but were unsuccessful in getting that done.
Let me ask you something, Mr.
Yes.
Do you lump all these defendants together? I mean, is it your allegation that their actions are the same, or is one?
Basically, yes, Your Honor. The breach of fiduciary duty that we are seeking to assert relates to a combined effort of Haynes and Boone and the directors with regard to essentially secret communications to certain members of the board, discussions about a plan of bankruptcy without publicly revealing that or discussing that with the other board members. The Woolleys, and there were actually two others, a man named Ray Rodriguez and a man named Fleur Muthon. Neither of those are parties to this action. There was a prior adversary action filed by the debtor in possession against, or the creditors committee, against the Woolleys. And at least for a period of time, Fleur Muthon, I believe, was one of the defendants there, but was subsequently dismissed.
All right, so the Woolleys are the people that ran Schlotzky's.
They were the I think Mr. John Woolley was the president and chief executive officer. Jeff Woolley was the senior vice president. They were in charge of management.
And they ran it into bankruptcy, and now they're...
Well, I think they might characterize it differently, Your Honor, but it went into bankruptcy.
They might have, but that's what happened.
That's what happened. It went into bankruptcy, and there's no question about it.
And now they're trying to find anybody they can to get some money back from.
Well, really, for them and the creditors, the unsecured creditors, Your Honor, essentially get nothing.
Yeah. They're the people that had the franchises that cut them too close.
Yes, and the people who supplied the flour, did work for them, delivery work, etc. A lot of those people, I assume, did not are among the creditors.
Well, what if your clients would have known whatever it is the secrets were? What difference would it have made? Where's the harm?
Your Honor, I think that there might have been other actions taken, and certainly disclosures made to creditors and investors. During this period of time when they were in the, quote, zone of insolvency and they were having these secret discussions with certain board members, there were other people trading in the stock. There were people who were selling goods and services to Schlotzky's essentially increasing more debt. And so they have suffered harm. And also, though, with a breach of fiduciary duty claim, certainly against lawyers, and we're talking about here, this would be a Texas law claim, the Burrell versus Arce case clearly says that you don't have to show damage. You have to show a breach of fiduciary duty, and that it is if it is serious, and there can be potential harm as a result of it, then the court, and it's discretionary with the trial court that tries it, can forfeit all or some of the fee or benefit received by the lawyers. And Haynes and Boone was paid a substantial sum of money. And so there could be a substantial recovery for these creditors. Whether or not they are able to show some actual dollar damage as a result of that breach of fiduciary duty.
No, but once the bankruptcy plan is confirmed, there's no estate. So there has to be something in the plan that gives you specific authority to pursue these state claims. Now, where in that plan does it give you the authority to go forward with these state claims?
Your Honor, that you have to look at Section 7.7 of the plan. And 7.7 of the plan basically says that the reorganized debtor shall retain and shall have the exclusive right to enforce any claims, rights, and causes of action that the debtors or the estates may hold against any entity, including without limitation, any claims, rights, or causes of action arising under Chapter 5 of the Bankruptcy Code or any similar provisions of state law or any other statute or legal theory.
Well, isn't that so broad that it's too broad?
Well, that really is the principal issue here today, Your Honor. And I know we're not riding on a clean slate in the Fifth Circuit with regard to preservation of claims.
You probably have the worst panel you could have had. Looking at operating, Disciples of Christ.
I think any panel you had would have been bad.
Yeah,
well, I'm here to change your mind, Your Honor.
That's what the other lawyer said at the Houston airport that didn't realize there was a judge standing next to him as he was getting on the airplane. But I.
Is it your panel?
Your Honor, you have to start with United Operating and then look at Wyoming Drilling.
But United Operating, you have to specifically reserve. You can't just say any and all and please, dear Lord,
what,
something.
As I read United Operating, what was there, they were trying to assert some common law claims. And the only reservation there was any and all claims under the bankruptcy code. Pardon me. There was no specific reservation of anything other than bankruptcy code. So when they tried to assert common law claims, they said all that you reserved were bankruptcy code claims. And I agree that was all that was reserved there. So that our reservation is broader than that. It is not it's not controlled by United Operating. Then you look at the Wyoming
but
Drilling.
It's not specific and unequivocal. You've said all laws, all statutes, all everything. That's there, not going to get a reservation of a claim under our precedent.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the purpose behind those notices, the plan and the disclosures, that's not written for these defendants over here. It's not written for the people who would be potential defendants. It's not written to tell them we've got a potential claim against you. It's written for the benefit of creditors. So it should be not interpreted from the standpoint of how would a very sophisticated, well-educated bankruptcy lawyer interpret this? It should be interpreted from the standpoint of how a creditor would interpret it. And someone, I think of an unsophisticated creditor, perhaps somebody who did work for him, a plumber, who didn't get paid. He's not able to hire someone of the quality of a Haynes and Boone's bankruptcy lawyer might not be able to hire anybody. What is he going to determine when he reads the plan and the disclosure? He's going to read it and say, okay, I'm not getting any money now. There's nothing in the state, but they say they're going to retain all claims, any and all claims. They're going to investigate more claims, and if they find any more, they're going to pursue those. And I might actually get some money out of this. It should be how would a creditor interpret it, and if it is this, I think, unlike the United Operating, Wyoming Drilling, and the National Benevolent Association case, in this case you have the first clear, unambiguous reservation of all claims known and unknown. In National Benevolent Association, that really turned on whether it was unequivocal, because There they sort of over-defined. They retained the claims, if any, against professionals, but then they defined they had professionals capitalized and professionals lowercase, and the plan defined professionals capitalized as those employed for services during the bankruptcy. And what the court said, well, yeah, you could read this to retain these pre-petition claims against professionals, but you could read it as only retaining claims against professionals for services performed during bankruptcy. It was ambiguous. It wasn't unequivocal. The one here is unequivocal. There's no doubt. There's no ambiguity. We intend to retain all of them. What is the alternative for someone trying to draft a plan that will retain everything, all Texas causes of action, say, because it's a Texas case? Well, they could go get Judge Michael O'Connor's book on Texas causes of action and start on page one and list them all. But that really would not advance the administration of justice or the administration of this bankruptcy, and it wouldn't assist the creditor who should be considered. How would he interpret this? He would interpret that it is preserved. I submit, and therefore, you also look at who are the drafters of this. The principal drafters of this are the appellees, Haynes and Boone, and the outside directors. I think it's clear that the intent was to preserve all causes of action. So either these very sophisticated bankruptcy lawyers and parties drafted something that didn't do what was clearly their intent to do, and now argue that it doesn't do it, or they came in and said, we know that this is not going to preserve anything, but we're going to draft it as if it does, because then it wouldn't preserve any claims against us, and the creditors are not going to realize that, and essentially build in a gotcha. And it is the thing that Judge Lynn referred to in a footnote in the Wyoming drilling case in the bankruptcy court opinion, that it's an opportunity for attorneys or parties to game the system. And under either scenario, whether that was their intent and they just now are arguing that wasn't their intent, or it was an opportunity to game the system, to hold that these claims weren't preserved is inequitable and unjust and doesn't serve the creditors. I submit to you that clearly the intent was, and it is unambiguous, that these claims were reserved.
Did you object to the plan?
They did not object. Woolies did not object to the plan. There were some objections filed
to the attorney's fees when that was determined by the bankruptcy court.
No, Your Honor.
Did they raise an objection to the attorney's fees?
I don't believe they objected to the attorney's fees. I can tell you, Your Honor, I didn't try this case, but my recollection is they did not object to the attorney's fees. That really goes to the issue of the derivative standing and the arguments as to whether or not the Woolies. A claim is colorable. Under Louisiana World Exposition, in order to have the derivative standing, you have to show it's a colorable claim, that the administrator, the debtor, has refused to pursue the claim, and that you have permission from the bankruptcy court to proceed. And the court noted in that opinion that those were relevant considerations, not a rigid formula. They say that one of the basis upon which Haynes and Boone says that the claims are barred was because it's not colorable because of res judicata. The only thing that was litigated in that fee approval, Your Honor, was the conduct of the lawyers and their performance of services during bankruptcy. The claim that we are asserting was pre-bankruptcy. So you under your transaction test as to whether or not...
Why isn't that, if it's pre-bankruptcy, why isn't there a statute of limitations barring that?
Statute of limitations would almost always involve fact questions, and fact questions are here. The, quote, colorability is really whether or not the plaintiff's claim is frivolous on its face, whether or not, under any set of facts that they've alleged, they could prove a claim. What they say is, well, it's barred by limitations. Limitations is an affirmative defense, and they would have to essentially establish that, Your Honor. So it is a triable fact issue.
Okay,
thank
we'll
you.
Save some time for rebuttal. Right, Mr. Everett.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Everett, and I represent Haynes and Boone. The Woolleys spent years, Your Honors, trying to convince somebody to pursue alleged claims and causes of action against Haynes and Boone for work that we did both before and after the petition date. First, the Woolleys tried to persuade the creditors committee in the Chapter 11 case, who were represented by very able and reputable counsel who were not associated with anybody at either table. The creditors committee gave that very careful consideration and said no thank you. The Woolleys then tried to persuade the plan administrator to pursue claims and causes of action. The plan administrator likewise looked at it and said no thank you. A quick review of the motion that the Woolleys then filed to pursue the claims themselves reveals in part why nobody wanted to pursue the claims. On page one of our brief, we quote in full the attachment to the Woolleys' motion that has seven very vague and conclusory allegations with respect to Haynes and Boone. I'm just going to read you the first one to give you a flavor. A, breach of fiduciary duty. Officers, directors, and professionals. Failure to fairly advise the entire board of directors, providing different. And then it stops mid-sentence. The rest of the allegations don't get much better. Under Louisiana World Exposition, the Woolleys had a burden to show that the claims were colorable and that the plan administrator unjustifiably refused to pursue the claims. I'm going to address those issues, and because of time limitations, we're going to rest on our brief with respect to the standing issue, and counsel for outside directors is going to address standing. Point number one, Your Honor. All post-petition claims against Haynes and Boone are barred by res judicata. Under Section 330A3 of the Bankruptcy Code, when a professional in a bankruptcy case files a fee request, the bankruptcy court has an obligation to consider all relevant factors. And if a professional is breaching fiduciary duties or is committing malpractice, that is a factor that a court must consider when awarding fees. Under this, as this court noted in Analogic Trace, even in the absence of an objection, when a court approves a fee request, there's an implied finding of quality and value. Haynes and Boone did file a fee request. It was not objected to by the Woolleys or anybody else. And in fact, the bankruptcy court and the district court both specifically found that the debtor and the creditors committee and the Woolleys had actual and inquiry notice about the claims and causes of action against Haynes and Boone.
Did the claim, the Haynes and Boone claim, include pre-bankruptcy work?
No, our fee request was for post-petition work.
All post-petition?
All post-petition work.
Because now they're saying that the claim is for pre-bankruptcy work.
They're arguing both, Your Honor. In the brief, they say their primary claims are pre-petition, which means there's some claims that are post-petition. But under Analogic Trace, we have them dead to rights with respect to post-petition claims. They didn't object. They could have and should have, and they didn't. I do agree that making the res judicata argument with respect to pre-petition claims is a little bit tougher for us. But just to give you an example of why it's not so easy to separate pre- and post-petition claims, one of the other allegations on their list, and it was referred to in argument, is that Haynes and Boone had a conflict. So apparently we had some conflict prior to the petition date. When we were retained, a professional cannot be retained in a bankruptcy case unless they're disinterested and they have no conflicts. So if we had a conflict before the petition date, where were they when we filed the application to be retained? They could have alleged that conflict as a basis for not employing Haynes and Boone.
What's the substance of the conflict?
I don't know. It's not addressed. I don't know what conflict that is.
It's
a secret conflict. So the district court did note that although that's an interesting issue about whether res judicata could bar pre-petition claims, ultimately the court didn't have to go there because there's an easy out on that, which is that the pre-petition claims are barred by limitations. And that's point number two. There's three critical dates I think I would like to focus on. The first one is August 3rd, 2004. That's the date that the bankruptcy petition was filed. The next critical date is August 3rd, 2008. That's fast-forwarding 4 years. The longest possible limitations that they've alleged is for breach of fiduciary duty, which has a 4-year limitations. We don't think that there could be a breach of fiduciary duty claim, but nevertheless, 4 years brings them forward to August 3rd, 2008. Unless there's a tolling provision, their claim was barred on August 3rd, 2008. They didn't file the motion to pursue claims until December 2008, several months after the deadline. There's a brief reference in argument, and there's briefing on an alleged secret meeting between Haynes and Boone and the outside directors. First, I'd like to point out that there were no allegations whatsoever before the bankruptcy court about this secret meeting. In fact, at trial, counsel for Haynes and Boone stated that there were no arguments about any discovery rule, and there was no evidence before the court about any type of a discovery tolling type argument. And counsel for the Woolies never refuted that point. And we cite, the record cite to that is found at footnote 11 of our brief. In addition, there was a related appeal that went all the way up to this court. The Woolies filed a motion to reconsider after they lost and attached a bunch of stuff that the bankruptcy court excluded from the record, including a deposition testimony where they alleged the evidence of the secret meeting is. The bankruptcy court excluded that from the record, and that went all the way up to this court in appeal number 1151108. And this court affirmed the lower court's determination that that evidence was not properly part of the record. Even though the Woolies didn't argue the discovery rule, the bankruptcy court made specific findings that the Woolies had actual and inquiry notice about the claims at issue, and they cannot now show that those findings were clearly erroneous. In addition, the discovery rule was not raised below, as I mentioned, and under this court's Ginther Trust case and multiple others, arguments that are raised for the first time on appeal are waived. A third point, Your Honor, has to do with whether the plan administrator unjustifiably refused to pursue the claims. The plan administrator's counsel testified at the hearing on the motion to pursue claims without contradiction that the bankruptcy state had no money to pursue the claims, that they had asked the Woolies to present the attorney that they said was willing to take the case, and they didn't, or they wouldn't. He also testified that there were legal hurdles to overcome, and that pursuing the claims against Haynes and Boone would require him to take inconsistent positions with those that he had taken in the case before. In the face of that, the bankruptcy court said, and I quote, I cannot in good conscience find that the plan administrator's refusal to bring the cause of action was unjustifiable. It was unjustifiable at all kind of levels. The Woolies have not shown and cannot show that this finding was clearly erroneous. Your Honor, I'm going to cede the balance of my time, and I'm going to let counsel for the outside directors address standing. But for the reasons that I've addressed here, for the reasons that we've additionally briefed, we ask that the court affirm the district court in full.
All right, thank you. Mr. McKenzie.
May it please the court. My name is Alfred McKenzie, and along with Shad Robinson, I represent the outside director, appellees. I will be addressing the Woolies' first issue on appeal, whether the reorganized debtor and thus the Woolies lacked standing to pursue breach of fiduciary duty, alleged Federal Securities Act violations, fraudulent concealment claims, and some unspecific claims regarding waste in the bankruptcy. It's clear on the record and under this court's prior decisions that they failed to specifically and unequivocally reserve those claims. Although I'm going to focus my argument on the lower court's application of this court's opinion in the United Operating case, I want to state at the outset that in the brief, the outside directors also advanced two alternative reasons for affirming the district court's judgment. And that's first, that the alleged claims the Woolies sought to assert against the outside directors were not colorable under Louisiana world because they were barred by res judicata. And secondly, that the Woolies failed to satisfy the requirements of Louisiana world that Mr. Everett just spoke about where the bankruptcy court found that the Woolies failed to show that the plan administrator unjustifiably refused to bring the claims. And I would point out in that regard, I would expect Mr. Kidd to argue in rebuttal that they don't need to show an unjustifiable refusal because that's simply one element of a loose test. But in this particular case, the bankruptcy court found that it was justifiable on all kinds of levels. And the Woolies have not challenged on appeal that finding of the bankruptcy court. Had they challenged it, they would have needed to raise an issue on appeal that that finding was against the clear evidence. They haven't even done that. So they're bound by, and the court should be bound by, the bankruptcy court's finding that the plan administrator was justified in refusing to bring the claims. And it's simply too late at the hearing on the motion to pursue claims for the Woolies to put on an attorney who would then say that that attorney would investigate those claims if allowed by the bankruptcy court and would consider prosecuting those claims on a contingent fee, particularly when the plan administrator's attorney said, if you have an attorney willing to do it on a contingent fee, send us that attorney's name, and that was refused. The question has to be examined at the point the plan administrator refused to bring the claims, not after that decision is made when they're before the court and they have an attorney saying he might consider them on a contingent fee. With regard to United Operating, the only claims that were arguably reserved by the plan of reorganization with any degree of specificity were claims, quote, arising under Chapter 5 of the Bankruptcy Code or any similar state law provision. The plan simply did not reserve unspecified claims, even categorically, for the breach of fiduciary duty and other common law claims that the Woolies now seek to assert in their motion to pursue claims.
But Haynes and Boone wasn't mentioned, or the specific claims were not mentioned.
That's right. Haynes and Boone was not mentioned in some of the early letters. It simply referred to directors and professionals. And one of the arguments that Haynes and Boone made at the hearing on motion to pursue claims is that could be any professionals. It might include Haynes and Boone. It might include others. It could, of course, also mean any directors. It might include the appellee directors, and it might include the couple of others who weren't raised in the motion to pursue claims. And so the plan doesn't name any particular cause of action other than, and this is the language that Judge Clark used, save and except the Chapter 5 claims. If that is categorical enough for this court, and I believe that the trend in the panel opinions is that a categorical reservation might be enough, it's certainly not specific with regard to claims that aren't mentioned at all. Breach of fiduciary duty doesn't come under Chapter 5. The fraudulent concealment common law claim doesn't come under Chapter 5 of the Bankruptcy Code. The only specific categorical retention would be claims under Chapter 5 and similar state law provisions. In United Operating, also known as Dynasty Oil, this court held that in order to preserve a claim, the plan must expressly retain the right to pursue such actions. The reservation must be specific and unequivocal. And if a debtor has not reserved that claim, then the debtor has no standing to assert it post-confirmation. There's really only one distinction between United Operating and this case. In United Operating, the court determined that neither the plan's blanket reservation of any and all claims under the code nor its specific reservation of other types of claims under various code provisions was sufficient to preserve common law claims for fraud and breach of fiduciary duty. In this case, Section 7.7 purports to categorically retain any claims, rights, or causes of action under Chapter 5 or similar state law provisions, and then adds what I would describe as a catch-all.
But then it says, or any other statute or legal
right.
I think that's what they're hanging their
hat on. And that's the catch-all. In fact, I think what they're hanging their hat on is a sentence that counsel almost touched on that's in their brief. At page 19 in their brief, they say, likewise, this plan, meaning that catch-all phrase, or any other statute or legal theory, they say, this plan is as specific as is possible to be when retaining all claims and causes of action. And you know what? I think that's right. But they're wrong. That is specific as you can be if you're trying to be general. But general is not specific. In other words, a plan simply cannot retain any and all claims.
So what was Haynes and Boone doing drafting this catch-all?
Well, the plan was actually drafted with the involvement of a number of other parties, including the Woolies. The Woolies did file an objection to the plan. They filed an objection to the disclosure, and those are in the record at bankruptcy document 1230 is their objection to the disclosure statement. Bankruptcy document 1280 is their objection to the plan. And in fact, they got section 7.7 amended, but that they amended it regarding the time for asserting a motion to pursue claims. They didn't seek to amend the language regarding what specific claims were retained. And as the Haynes and Boone lawyer argued at the motion to pursue claims, it would have been ridiculous for the attorney for the debtor, who is bound with an obligation to present a plan to the bankruptcy court in good faith, to at the same time, in good faith, say to the bankruptcy court, by the way, we believe that we, Haynes and Boone, have committed malpractice. It is ridiculous to presume that that party would have that burden. But when parties like the Woolies were, as the bankruptcy court found, extensively involved in shaping the plan, had every opportunity to raise these claims and put them in the plan, they shouldn't be permitted to come before this court and say, we didn't draft the plan. The bankruptcy, as Mr. Robinson argued, that the motion to pursue claims is in a fishbowl, and that everything that the debtor does is in the open and is subject to supervision by the bankruptcy court. And so the Woolies had an opportunity to present the very claims that, by the way, several months previously they had already made demand upon Don Campbell, the creditors committee's attorney, to assert. And Don Campbell said, you know, I don't think that those are valid claims. They had been rejected in 2005, before the plan was confirmed in 2006. So the only thing that they are newly asserting is that they discovered subsequently to the plan confirmation some evidence of an alleged secret meeting. And as Mr. Everett said, there's no evidence in the record before this court at the motion to pursue claims about what that evidence is. They tried in the motion to reconsider to bring it in, that was stricken. But that subsequent evidence is like the evidence in Interlogic Trace, where under a res judicata analysis, I believe that was in the Interlogic Trace. In a res judicata analysis, the court said, when you're looking at whether a claim could have been brought previously, whether it was known to the parties, it's not important that there may have been some basic facts that weren't known and that the debtor had not yet made a conclusion to bring the claim. As long as you can link up the allegations, and the Woolies had clearly in their letter, which is in the record, to Don Campbell, asserted some breaches of fiduciary duties against the outside directors. So if they had a claim, they should have asserted it when they made their objections to Section 7.7 of the plan. Your Honor, this is simply not a case in which the court should feel compelled to revisit the specific and unequivocal requirements set out by this court in In Re United Operating in Texas, Wyoming. And specifically, Judge Clement, with regard to Texas, Wyoming, if this court had believed that the language any and all claims, which was the beginning of the plan in Texas, Wyoming, and then said including under Chapter 5, if any and all claims was sufficient, Judge Clement, you wouldn't have had to go through the analysis of the action, the claims that were defined in the disclosure statement, because the catch-all would have satisfied the requirement. And with that, I say my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kidd, you have 5 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to standing and the preservation of claims, I want to again bring the court back to who is the reader here. Who is this, the audience that this has been written for? It is for the creditor. I don't think there's anything I'm not a real bankruptcy practitioner, but anything that says that all claims can't be preserved. They have to be preserved in the plan. It has to be unequivocal and specific. But the specificity requirement is what you're looking for. How do you communicate to a creditor that we are planning to retain each and every claim, other than to say so?
Well, that's the opposite of specific.
Except, Your Honor, you could go in again and list every cause of action that the lawyer could think of as a potential claim, because it's clear.
It won't be specific if he doesn't name the potential debtor.
Your Honor, I think that, as I interpret, I think Wyoming Drilling, you don't have to identify defendants. You have to identify claims, and you have to get, you can do that by category. If we went out and just listed breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, breach of contract, and went through the list of all potential causes of action under—
But it has to be good faith pleading as an officer of the court.
But if you're saying, I want to retain all causes of action known or unknown, and actually saying it that way is insufficient—
That's not going to work. Under our jurisprudence, that's not going to work.
I submit that it should, Your Honor.
Well, then you'll have to get something to go on bonk.
Perhaps, Your Honor. But I think that clearly you could be able to you should be able to retain any and all causes of action.
Well,
how do you do that?
Then you have to take specific out of the law.
Well, as if you are retaining all causes of action, about as specific, especially unknown ones, about as specific as you could be, is we're retaining all of them, including all unknown ones.
Well, you can't reserve all unknown ones.
Well, that, Your Honor, I think would be unfair and inequitable to the creditors, because that's who benefits from these claims. You have these creditors who are not going to get a dime.
Then the creditors need to come in with specifics.
But, Your Honor, a lot of those creditors are not going to have people like Mr. Albergati from Haynes and Boone representing them. They can't. So they should be able to read this description and say, okay, I understand they're retaining them all.
Well, you had some. Now you're saying you had some claims, a breach of fiduciary claims. Why didn't you say that? Why didn't you modify this to make it specific?
Well, I think that
you were serious at the time.
At the time, I think their conclusion was that this was sufficient to do it. I can't really answer why the people who were there drafting the plan at the time did not specify breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, etc. I can't answer that because I was not there.
Well, they're probably going to get sued by the Boones.
Well,
the Woolies.
I don't know, Your Honor. I think both, in all honesty, I think both the drafters at this table and the representatives of the Woolies at the time thought this sufficient to do it. That was their intent. And since that is their intent, it would be, I think, unfair and inequitable to the creditors not to effectuate that intent. The result should not be that it benefits essentially potential wrongdoers to the detriment of the creditors, when clearly there was a clear expressed intent to reserve all causes of action. And I see that I'm about out of time, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kidd.